This is Issues and Ideas here on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Randall White. From the moment Central Coast Congresswoman Lois Capps announced her plans to retire at the end of this term, candidates looking to fill her spot began to announce their intentions to run. KCBX is inviting each registered candidate onto the show, Issues and Ideas, in order to share their visions for the 24th Congressional District, which includes all of San Luis Obispo County, all of Santa Barbara County, and a little portion of Ventura County in the Los Padres National Forest. William Ostrander is a farmer in San Luis Obispo County and serves as the director of a nonprofit called Citizens Congress. He's also a real estate developer, and he joins us in studio to discuss his vision for serving the 24th District should he be elected to the seat in November 2016. Welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Now, you say yourself that you're not a career politician, so what made you run for office this time around?
Well, I've been doing work outside of the government for decades. I've been a Big Brother for 35 years. I've worked on four continents. I worked in Africa as a self-funded volunteer on conservation issues, specifically relating to community development, because the issues in conservation are oftentimes best served by looking at what's going on in the community, the people around those conservation issues. So I started the first all-public library, donated public library in Africa. I started programs for scholarships for kids to get to school, a work-based program for adults to have products that they could sell to tourism. And I helped to build a craft center there and start a cultural festival, which brought money into that community, which is highly impoverished. I mean, 85% unemployment. I mean, you know, it's a tough place to live.
This is Namibia?
This is Namibia, yeah. So I've done work like that. I've been a spokesperson for Coalition to Stop Food Irradiation. I've been a member of the Sierra Club. I've done beach cleanup. I've been doing Citizens Congress work, which is trying to remove the corruptive influence of money in politics. I've given congressional briefings in Washington, D.C. I've visited and lobbied over 65 different offices in the House and Senate. And for me, it just came down to the time where I felt like I had to do something within the system as opposed to constantly being outside the system, because the reforms that we need to have to happen within. It's the system itself that needs to be changed. And I just felt that it was time to make that choice to work inside for a while.
Now, if you were to win this seat, would you continue to run until at which time you don't?
Are you asking me if I were reelect, could I go for reelection?
Would you run for reelection year after year until you lose?
I assume that I would run again or look at other public office, depending on the effectiveness of what I was doing. At the end of the day, what's most important is making some changes, and I think that 2 years in the House of Representatives is not really enough time to get all of these changes done that I think that we need to do. And I think it's really important that people understand that I think the Founding Fathers' intention for making the House of Representatives' tenure just a very short time, 2 years, is because they were constantly looking for cycling in of the populace to come into government, to participate in government, and re-envision where the country's at and where it's going. So the answer to your question is yes, I would most likely seek re-election, but I think that depends on, first of all, if people are happy with what I'm doing, and secondly, if I'm being most effective there.
Now, your organization, Citizens Congress, focuses on big money in American politics, and you say a huge sum of money is needed to run a viable campaign. So how will you run a viable campaign without leaning on the contributions of a few wealthy contributors or special interests?
Well, I think if you look at, let's say, Bernie Sanders, for example, right now, when you look at the FEC filings after the second quarter, Bernie Sanders leads all the candidates in terms of candidate funding, not in terms of their aggregate funding, like their PACs, their super PACs, et cetera, but in terms of actual donations to the candidates themselves. Bernie Sanders had $15.7 million, which was far and away above everybody else in the field. When you start looking at the percentage of those people who have or percentage of that total donations came from small donors, I mean, Bernie Sanders' numbers were like over 80%, and the average donation was about $43. When you think of the amount of support that there, that's incredible. So I don't necessarily feel that I can do without money. That's not that's not possible. You do have to have money. You have to have campaign managers. You have to set up websites, print graphic materials, you know, get out and see people, you know, and that all costs money. But do I think that we need to have what would probably be close to $12 million to win this race? And I'm not saying one candidate has to have $12 million, but in aggregate, I think all the candidates are probably going to spend close to $12 million. That's obscene. We don't need to have that kind of money in politics, because 80 to 90% of that money is going to be coming from outside the area, not from within the area, not from the people here making that decision. So, yes, we need to have money in politics. Yes, I need your help. Yes, I need your small donations. But I'm the only candidate who's been willing to sign the People's Pledge, which is to refuse independent expenditure money, to refuse dark money from coming out of the area.
As a farmer, how do you feel about groundwater rights in the midst of this four-year drought?
Well, like any natural resource, we have to look at it essentially as a public resource. And a public resource means just that, that it's not owned by one person. I think we're in for some real interesting fights coming up, because there's long been constitutional law that said that anybody who owned a piece of property was entitled to water rights underneath that. But I don't know that in those days when those laws were first written, that they recognized the aquifer spreads across many, many properties, and that creates another issue all the time. But there are many things that we should be doing about water that also have to do with carbon sequestration, farming, climate change, et cetera, that are all together, and we need to look at that issue more holistically rather than looking at, I need my water and screw everybody else.
And are there specific things that you would do in Congress if you were elected to, A, help California's drought situation, and B, some of the issues you just brought up?
Well, of course, first of all, everybody's interested in climate change, or I should say most people are interested in climate change. And when you look at climate change, one of the places that we're really not looking enough to is agriculture. Agriculture provides probably about 20% of our carbon footprint in the world. And reason for that is because of tilling and over-tilling and petrochemicals and the way that we're farming. Now, the value of looking at sequestering carbon in agriculture, or sequestering carbon in the land, which is, of course, a feature of agriculture, has other benefits like refilling ground aquifers. And let me explain. When you go in and you till a field, you lose between one-third and three-quarters of an inch of rainfall moisture out of that soil.
Not only that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but what you're doing is you're tilling up all the biodegradable materials as well as the root systems. It's those root systems which are really key here, because plants, as you know, pull carbon dioxide out of the air and they put it into the soil. And when those root systems die, they create kind of a humus. And that humus holds that carbon for long periods of time. So when you look at the different carbon banks we have in the world, we have the oceans, we have the atmosphere, and we have the soil. Well, we already know the oceans are already turning acidic. And we already know that the atmosphere has way more parts of carbon than it can hold healthfully. So the soil is one of the last places we can do that. And we can sequester carbon in that soil by not tilling so much, by planting cover crops, by altering some of our land use means or methods. And what's important to that in terms of the drought, why that makes it locally relevant, is when you till a field, when it rains, the water comes down and creates a crust on top of that tilled soil. Not only does it create a crust, but in some cases it washes that soil away. And we're losing 4 tons of topsoil per person in the United States today. Okay, so when you create that crust, what happens is the water that hits on top of that is now just running off, going into our streams, our creeks, our rivers, and eventually into the oceans or lakes or whatever. But when you don't till that soil, all those healthy root systems, which are growing deeper and deeper, that are sequestering carbon, when they're torn up, the water doesn't have the chance to infiltrate. When the root systems are there, those become little avenues for water to get into the ground. And we can take in 6 to 8 times as much water in no-till ground as we can in tilled ground. Now, when we take that water in, that water has a chance to percolate down, get into our aquifers. And that means that all of us benefit. So it's really important, and these things dovetail one another. The carbon sequestration, healthy soils, keeping nutrients in the soil that eventually make their way into our food systems, not having erosion, not filling up the Gulf of Mexico with algae blooms due to fertilizer runoff and nitrogen and soils. And we can at the same time bring water back into our aquifers that we all get benefit from. So it's a big problem and a good solution there.
And you've lobbied Congress on behalf of sustainable agriculture. Were these some of the topics that you were pushing Congress to take action on?
I specifically lobby Congress on money in politics. This is something that I don't think people understand. I think emotionally people have a sort of a gut reaction. Yes, there's too much money in politics. And when you look at the polls, they say 96% of Americans believe that money is having a corruptive influence in politics. But 91% of the people believe there's nothing we can do, which is just wrong. It's false. But one of the reasons that we can't get people to motivated in this issue is because I don't think that a lot of people are able to connect legislative outcomes with their personal lives. But you take any issue going before Congress today. You can take a foreign policy issue. Let's just say like the Iran nuclear deal. You've got Sheldon Adelson, who is having a big impact on that on the Iran deal because of his associations with Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel.
Sheldon Adelson is the Las Vegas
casino magnate, right? And his influence is huge. And if you look at what's going on right now in the presidential we're not even to the primary yet, but what's happening is what we call the invisible primary. Every candidate out there is looking and seeking for a billionaire benefactor who can then help to bankroll their candidacy. We saw in 2012, I think it was, in the Republican primary, Newt Gingrich stayed in the race solely because of one benefactor, solely. It was Sheldon Adelson. That was the only person that kept him in there. Otherwise, his candidacy would have failed long before. So you took it any particular issue, whether that's immigration, whether that's climate change, whether that's food security, whether it's, you name it. It has to go through a labyrinth of money. And the outcomes that come out of that filter down to you and I, are usually diluted or not in our best interest. And it's money that's making that difference.
What are your views on oil exploration along the Central Coast and the use of methods such as fracking to retrieve that oil?
Well, I think we need to understand, first of all, that fossil fuels are 20th century. We really need to be spending a considerable greater amount of energy seeking alternative energy. And again, money in politics. If you look at the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is funded by a lot of very conservative types, they're trying to create legislation that slows down the process of our transition into alternative fuels. So exploring oil along the Central Coast is not a good idea. We've seen the environmental impacts just in Refugio Beach just recently. It's something that we have to wean ourselves from. It's not here. It's not going to go away immediately. But there are certainly a lot more energy that we should be spending on alternative energy means. I mean, Germany, for example, has a great project where they're putting solar panels on houses. And they fund that through the government. And then the interest that they pay, which is very slight, like 2%, goes to fund other people's houses. To continue to put solar panels on their house. And they're way ahead of their ambitions, of their goals of getting, I think it was 25% of their population on solar energy by year 2025 or something like that.
Germany's program is remarkable considering the amount of sunshine that country
right.
gets.
Right,
on
and
top
think
of
what
all.
We should be doing here.
Phillips 66 is proposing a rail spur, as you know, to the company's Santa Maria refinery just west of Nipomo. Communities up and down the Southern Pacific Rail Line are expressing concern over an increase in oil trains that would create, if approved. Can you share with us your thoughts on how that project should or should not move forward?
Well, obviously it's a bad idea when you have that kind of risk along, 19 schools, 2 hospitals, through the downtowns. You've got one stretch of the grade where the trains come down, which is already ranked as one of the 5th most dangerous sets of tracks.
The Cuesta grade.
Yeah, the Cuesta grade. I mean, it clearly doesn't make sense. I mean, the flammability, the inflammability, I sometimes get the two words confused, but when they're putting a liquid in there to make that oil thinner so that it's transportable and more fluid, you're just increasing exponentially the destruction that could happen in an accident. And personally, there are just some accidents that just aren't worth taking the risk for. Maybe the trains would go by for years, but there's just not worth that risk. It's just not worth it.
PG&E is currently asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to renew its operating permits on the 2 reactors at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Would you say you're more in the camp with those who stand behind PG&E's studies saying the plant is seismically safe, or with those who express concern, including current 24th District Representative Lois Capps and former State Senator Sam Blakesley, who is himself an earthquake scientist?
Well, obviously there's concern there. Fukushima showed us that nothing is perfect, that their forces of nature can sometimes outdo even our expectations. I mean, the real concern with Diablo Canyon, ultimately, when you look at, you know, on one hand, some environmentalists will recognize that it's clean energy compared to fossil fuels or compared to coal. That's a good argument. Okay. And then there's another argument, which is you know, we don't have any place to take the waste. We don't have any place to store that. And that stuff that's half-life is, what, 10,000 years or longer? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years. And we don't have any means of storing that. So to me, that's a deal killer. But what we really have to focus on is the fact that PG&E is – employing 1,500 people, creating about $900 million worth of income in the county. So really what we should be studying is someday that plant will close down, whether it's this licensing or not, it will close down. So the bigger question is how to replace that energy, how to replace that money that's coming into the county, how do we get people into different jobs? So the environmental impacts of it, we already know, bad news. But it's there, and it's producing a type of energy right now. But let's look at all of the issues around that. Jobs, money in the county, what do we do with the materials, and that it will be unlicensed or delicensed at one point.
William Ostrander, San Luis Obispo County farmer, also the director of a nonprofit called Citizens Congress and a local real estate developer as well. Thank you so much for being on Issues and Ideas.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'd love to come back anytime and talk about all the other issues we have in front of us.
And this is Issues and Ideas here on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Randall White.